Vermont Viewpoint is a public affairs program produced and funded by WDEV and the Radio Vermont Group. We welcome listener feedback. Email your comments to vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com.
Good morning. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. I'm Rick Singeri. Canada had its second federal election in 2 years on Monday, and Canadians weren't particularly happy about having to endure a grueling 35-day campaign. So how did Canadian voters respond to such an outrage? By pretty much creating the exact same makeup of parliament that it had before the election. Why was an election called, and what do the results tell us about what's happening in Canada? Here to help us understand the results from Monday is St. Michael's College Political Science and International Relations Professor Jeff Ayres. He's also the director of the Center for Global Engagement. Jeff, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Happy to be back.
Great to have you. Listeners, if you've got a question for Jeff about the Canadian election or some observations, you can give us a call at 244-1777, 877-291-8255. You can also email vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. So, Jeff, Canada just held their most recent election, federal election, 2 years ago. Why was this one held or called for?
Well, it was pretty clear it was held because Trudeau hoped that he would get a majority this time. I think he, over the course of this past summer, must have been looking at the polls, certainly saw that his government's handling of the pandemic was seen in a relatively good light by most Canadians, and the Conservative Party leader, O'Toole, wasn't well known, wasn't very popular. So I think that the goal was to call a snap election and hopefully get a majority government and not maintain the minority that he had, and it didn't work out.
Well, was he having any problems, any trouble getting particular legislation through with the minority government that he had?
No, that's a good question. And a lot of commentators in the last couple of days and even before that said, why call this election? Your government was actually functioning well. Yes, it was a minority. You had the balance of power depended on getting support either from the New Democratic Party or the Bloc Québécois. But being in the pandemic and functioning reasonably well and getting legislation passed and responding quite well to the pandemic left, as you opened with, many Canadians asking, why was this necessary?
And does he, I know it's a small contingent, does he also get support from the Green Party, which has a couple members of parliament?
He probably will. That's a good point. I mean, it's interestingly enough, the Green Party probably performed the worst. If there's any party that was a real loser this time, it was the Green Party. They lost a lot of support across the country. They had a lot of infighting leading up to the election. So it's likely that right now it looks like there'll be two Green Party members. One interesting point was there was first time ever a federal MP will be coming from Ontario to sit with the Green Party, but still, they'll probably support, but it's really it's the NDP or the Bloc that they can turn to get over they need 170 votes on the budget and other legislation.
And before we kind of gloss over this, let's talk about, how an election is scheduled or called in Canada compared to the U.S.
Yeah, it's interesting in that it was only a few years ago that legislation was passed setting a fixed election date so that in Canadians normally now expect to go to the polls for federal elections every 4 years. So there should have been another election in 2 years from now. But the Prime Minister still has the power to go to the Governor General. The Governor General is the representative of the head of state, those of us who go up to Canada and you look at the Canadian money, you still see the Queen on many of the bills. And so the Queen is the head of state and the Governor General is the Queen's representative. And so when Prime Minister Trudeau decided strategically to call an election, he really just went to the Governor General in Rideau Hall in Ottawa and asked her to dissolve Parliament, which she did. And they were off for as you noted, a short election campaign.
35 days was the full length, but it was the most expensive federal election ever held in Canada. That's another kind of bone of contention with voters. And before we get away from the Canadian system, let's make sure everybody understands no one actually votes for their prime minister like we do for our president. So explain how their system works.
Right. There's only Justin Trudeau is actually in one riding. He's in Papineau, a riding in Greater Montreal area. And so riding is like a congressional district. And so only the residents of that one riding saw Trudeau's name on the ballot. So they voted for him. He was reelected in his riding. He happens to be the leader of the party that got the plurality of the vote again, plurality of the seats, and therefore he remains prime minister. So you're right, 338 ridings across Canada, only one has the prime minister's name on it. So people all across the country are actually voting for MPs, members of parliament, in their riding, seeing what party might get a plurality or a majority to govern.
You need 170 to have that plurality, that majority in the parliament. Now, you've mentioned several of the other parties. First of all, the Liberals and the Conservatives, the two major parties right now, the leaders, I guess, in opposition. You've mentioned the National Democratic Party, or NDP, Bloc Québécois, which only runs in Quebec, only runs candidates there, the Green Party. But this year, actually 2 years ago, it formed. There is a new party, the People's Party of Canada, or PPC. What do they stand for, Jeff?
Yeah, the PPC is, you're right, a new relatively new party founded by Maxime Bernier. He's a disgruntled conservative from Quebec. He'd been a member of the Conservative Party, came very close to actually winning, becoming leader of the Conservative Party. He was beaten out by O'Toole, Aaron O'Toole, who's the leader. And you know, it's hard to say what the PPC stands for. What it's doing is receiving support from a number of people who are disgruntled. Certainly, it's becoming a populist. Seems like it's getting support from in a more populist, anti-immigrant, xenophobic way. This time, however, that what Bernier really capitalized on was it's a small minority, but there's a number of people, as there are in the United States, who are anti-vaxxers, anti-maskers, anti-lockdowns, and it's not a direct correlation, but it certainly seems clear that a number of the people who were dogging Trudeau on the campaign trail, a lot of loud protesters turning up, were supporters of the People's Party of Canada. So it's a bit of a growing trend, still very small, and they, even for the second time, Bernier didn't even win his own seat,
right,
and the PPC didn't actually get any seats. But there's no doubt that they took enough support from the Conservatives to, I think, reduce the number of seats the Conservatives probably would have won had the PPC not been running.
Election night in Canada, very interesting to watch because you have the Atlantic provinces an hour ahead. You get the early results there. And then at that point on Monday night, the Conservatives made some slight gains. But our pundits up north say you don't put a whole lot of stock in what happens out east in those Atlantic provinces. Why is that, Jeff?
Well, it's because there's not as many seats. There's far fewer. And 2015 was a different situation. In 2015, the Liberals swept every single seat in the Maritimes or the Atlantic provinces, which at that time pundits said, okay, this is different. This sends a signal. But I think the massive, if you were watching it, as was I, on the CBC or CTV, and you're waiting to get beyond the Atlantic provinces because it's the massive amounts of votes are in Quebec and Ontario, and then, of course, even further out in the prairies in Alberta. So it's just way too early to tell, by just looking at the results in the Atlantic provinces.
Now, what are the other, bones of contention for calling this early election? It was called during the pandemic at a time when the Delta variant has kicked up and caused numbers to spike again in places. We had several things that were similar to our election last November, reduced number of polling places throughout Canada larger number of mail-in ballots. Did that have any effect on turnout and the election results?
You know, it's not clear whether it had an impact on the results. I mean, we're still waiting. I think right now there's quite a few seats that haven't been called. And that was it was interesting to watch on election night. Pundits and newscasters were all very clear in saying, look, there are going to be more mail-in ballots than we've ever had. And there was, interesting to me anyway, there was explicit reference to the United States. It seemed to be clear that the goal was to not have misinformation and create some sort of conspiracy about these mail-in ballots. And so they're still being counted. I don't think the fact that their mail-in had a big difference on the outcome. I do think the pandemic reduced turnout. I mean, the turnout right now, it's hovering around the lowest ever. So we're still waiting to see, you know, some votes counted. So it's a very low turnout. Clearly, people not very excited about this election, perhaps upset about the fact that it was taking place during a pandemic. So it reduced turnout.
All right, Jeff, we kind of talked about the eastern provinces, the Maritimes, but the bewitching hour, I think it's 9:30, a major swath of Canada's polls close. So let's move across the country, starting in Quebec. What happened there? Tell us if that was a surprise or if it was true to form, what we saw.
Yeah, what happened in Quebec, I don't think it was a surprise. I think it... You know, Quebec is always an important issue in these elections, and what happened in Quebec is the national and identity feelings and sentiments were galvanized. There was a particular moment in the English language debate. There's two debates: the French language and then English language debate, where the leader of the Bloc Québécois, Blanchette, was asked a question that seemed to insult and upset a number of Quebecers about legislation in the province that had to do with, really focusing particularly, as he responded, it focused on Quebec values and promoting the Quebec nation and language. But I think that helped the Bloc. So to answer your question more directly, I think the Liberals had a shot. Maybe even they might have even had a shot at a majority government, but the Bloc Québécois, it has kind of rebounded. I mean, a few years ago before, in 2015, it hadn't done well at all. It rebounded in 2019. And so the Bloc is the more separatist, or certainly the more nationalist group, the Bloc of MPs, if you will, in Quebec, who really represent and promote Quebec interests primarily. So that vote really split with the Liberals. Conservatives didn't do nearly as well. But I think we need to keep our eye on Quebec. Obviously, it's our northern neighbor. There's a provincial election within the province in 2022, and so it's interesting. The issue of Quebec sovereignty, of Quebec nationalism, it never goes away, and I think it had a bit of an impact in this election.
All right. Now on to Toronto and Ontario. A lot of seats there. What did we see?
Well, we saw no real surprises there. In fact, if there was a surprise, it was the surprise for conservatives that they didn't do as well as they'd hoped. I mean, what we saw was the Liberals just more or less swept all of Toronto and the greater Toronto area, and which is where huge chunks of votes come from. The Liberals also did very well in Ottawa. That's where the bigger cities in Ontario that's where the Liberals got the largest number of seats. Conservatives did well in Ontario. NDP also got some seats, but the Liberals really benefit from that's consistently for so long now been where most of the Liberal support or a big part of the Liberal support comes from.
Maybe the biggest surprise was Kingston, the Kingston Center riding, which went green. Kingston, of course, the home of the Canadian icons, the Tragically Hip. But it was interesting to see a green victory in the middle of Ontario.
It was. I think what's more interesting, perhaps, is for me, is how badly the party did. I mean, the party... Mm-hmm. There was all this intra fighting, and I think there was a lot of anticipation coming out of the 2019 election because a Green Party member had actually been elected in the Maritimes.
Yep.
That person ended up leaving the Greens and going to the Liberals, and it looks like right now she's going to hold that seat. So it was a surprise to see the Greens get a seat in Ontario, but it's pretty insignificant right now. You need 12 seats to even have official parliamentary status, so they've got a long way to go to make a big difference, I think, in Canadian politics.
There was a section out in the prairies where the NDP, the National Democratic Party, did fairly well. Why do they resonate in that part of the country?
Well, there's a long history of NDP, New Democratic Party support in the early on, the CCF, the Cooperative Commonwealth Federation, preceded the NDP, and there's a kind of deep history there, and interestingly, more rural, coming out of the Great Depression and support for social democracy. But I think it's as the NDP has evolved, it's become a more urban-based party. And yes, it's kind of interesting. The last place I've been in Canada before the pandemic was Edmonton. I flew up from Montreal to Edmonton, and I think some of my friends up there will be happy to see another NDP seat. So there's two NDP seats up there now. Maybe looks like there may be a Liberal seat, but it's still not that easy. Saskatchewan, none. A few in Manitoba. It's BC, that British Columbia, where the NDP has almost become the second party, or it's a real force out in British Columbia.
Where are they politically on the spectrum, the NDP?
Yeah, the New Democratic Party is definitely the left, the more left of center. It's the socialist, social democratic party. It's the Jagmeet Singh, their leader, was reelected in his riding in BC, and it's interesting that sure the Liberals could turn to the Bloc, the Bloc will support the Liberals on a number of issues, but the NDP will put a lot of pressure on the Liberals for increasing taxes on the rich. That's one of their major campaign planks, increasing health care funding. So the Liberals are center left, but they do a great the natural governing party is their nickname. They do a great job of kind of moving around the center, but the NDP is solidly left, and I think that in part explains why they do well out in the Pacific Northwest.
All right, let's move on to the conservative stronghold. The Tories in Saskatchewan, Alberta, kind of eastern BC, and it looks like they really hold that section of the country pretty tightly.
Yeah, they do. It's difficult to break through. There's a long history there. Decades long, if not going all the way back to Confederation, history of somewhat of the two solitudes in the Je me souviens and real concerns about, understandable concerns about Quebecers, Francophone Quebecers wanting to maintain their language rights. The West always, for many in the West, it's the West once in, or there's been a long history of Western alienation. Mm-hmm. And really going back to Justin Trudeau's father, Pierre Trudeau, many people, especially in Alberta, don't like the Trudeau name, certainly don't support the Liberals. I will say, though, there were a couple breakthroughs. I mean, the premier of Alberta is getting hammered right now. Jason Kenney, back in the summer, he had more or less declared the pandemic over, and Alberta's having a horrible time in the pandemic right now, with deaths and with increasing cases. And I think that hurt the conservative brand, which allowed, it looks like there's a Liberal victory in Calgary, and as I said, a Liberal victory up in Edmonton. And still, even though large support for the Conservatives, what we often don't look at is the actual breakdown of the vote within the provinces. And so there's still some support for the Liberals and the NDP in those areas. But you're right, that's where the solidly conservative bloc is in Canada.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned that out in BC, it's Liberal and it's NDP. But overall, we go, back with the new parliament with virtually no change. So why was it? Why did we see, like this didn't even happen, Jeff?
I'm going to risk my French. Plus ça change, plus ça même chose, right? The more things change, the more they stay the same. And I think it happened in part because, Canadians, it's almost like a right now, there were no major issues during the campaign. It was actually, it wasn't a campaign. It wasn't a very strong campaign with vision. It was Trudeau saying, look, this is an important election, and I want to give Canadians an opportunity to have a mandate to pick a government that can lead us coming out of this pandemic. And I think what it showed was most Canadians, overwhelmingly preferred that there not be an election, and there was very little movement. It's really interesting that there very, very little movement, only by a seat or two for the parties right now was there any kind of a change. So I think the way we started out this conversation, the expensive cost of the election, why did you run this? Why did you call this during the pandemic? There will be some questions for Trudeau from his caucus and some kind of questions about the effectiveness of his leadership going into this third government, now second minority government.
Yeah, I stayed up all night. I could have gone to bed at 9:45. Does Trudeau lose any political capital for taking this gamble?
You know, I think he does. I think I don't know what will happen. I think if the Liberals had lost a number of seats, let's say they had a dramatically reduced minority, or certainly if the Conservative Party had gained a minority, there may have been some open discussion and grumbling about whether, you know, he should remain as leader. I suspect, you know, there'll be a much more graceful exit. I don't know. I mean, I can't imagine he'd want to stay on for another election campaign. But then again, he is a bit like his father. He's, mm-hmm. He has a certain air of entitlement about him. Mm-hmm. I will say that. And I think who knows how long he'll stay on. But I think he's lost a little capital. I think there'll be some continual questions and debates about whether this was even necessary.
All right. Well, if we don't speak to you before then, you and I will get together when the Quebec elections come up.
That sounds great.
Next year. Jeff Ayres is a St. Michael's College political science and international relations professor, and he's the director of the Center for Global Engagement. Jeff, thanks so much for getting us up to speed on politics in Canada.
I really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot, Rick.
Take care. All right, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to discuss Indigenous Peoples Day and the celebration that's going on October 9th in Stowe. And the Red Sox wrap up their two-game series at home with the Mets tonight. Our coverage begins at 6:10, first pitch at 7:10. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
Welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint. I'm Rick Singeri. The land we now call Vermont is the land of the Abenaki. And each year now, on Indigenous Peoples Day, we have the opportunity to celebrate the heritage of the Abenaki and learn more about their customs and history. This year, on Saturday, October 9th, there will be a great event for you to participate in Stowe, where you'll be able to do just that. Indigenous Peoples Day Rocks is a partnership with the Mohegan Abenaki and Stowe Vibrancy. Joining me now to discuss this special day is Don Stevens. He's chief of the Mohegan Band of the Cusick Abenaki Nation. Chief Stevens, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thank you. Kwekwe Nidomba. Hello, friends.
Hello there. All right. We also have with us this half hour Peter Schmickley, the music director of the Indigenous Peoples Day Rocks. Peter, thank you for being here as well.
Sure. Good morning. Thanks.
Good morning. And M.A. Green is the executive director of Stowe Vibrancy. Welcome.
Good morning.
All right. We have a full contingent. I'm going to start with you, Chief. This is a perfect opportunity for Vermonters to learn more about the Abenaki people. Can you give us a little history of the presence of the Abenaki in this area?
Well, we've been here for, you know, thousands of years. I think archaeological studies go back 11 or 12,000 years. But, you know, we were of this place, and the place is of us. That's why a lot of things are named based on place, like Mohegan River, Mohegan Basin is named after us, means place of the wooden traps, Missisquoi, place of the flint. So we have been rooted in this place since our existence. So the schools don't often teach about us, and in 2011 we actually had to show that we were still here and that we have always been here, and we have a living, vibrant culture. And that's when we went for recognition to be legally out of extinction, I should say, or legally here as an Indian tribe. So that's a process no one should have to go through, but we did it, and we're here, and we have a rich culture, and we're happy to partner with others like Stowe Vibrancy to help bring our culture to the forefront.
Yeah, and I remember when the legislature did that. It was a great moment in Vermont history and for the Abenaki. And tell us about the Abenaki people, you know, thousands of years ago. I know they did move about. They had settlements. Tell us what they were like.
Yeah, my ancestors, you know, we, like I said, we were part of the land. The land was part of us. We shared it with the trees and the animals. And we basically, the woods and the land was our grocery stores. So in the wintertime, we would move into the wintering grounds, which would be more of the woods, where, you know, most people know that deer yard. You know, if people hunt, they go to, you know, deer kind of go in the pines, which we are people of the pines. Because the snow is less, and we would hunt the big game animals like moose and deer and turkey and all those woodland animals. And then when the spring started, we'd start moving into the floodplains where the floods would leave fertile soil on the riverbanks, and it was easier to turn the soil and actually get fish for fertilizer. And we would hunt waterfowl and, you know, eat the things that are near the water, and it would also be our transportation routes. So it would, this cycle would allow the animals to replenish in different areas, so we wouldn't, you know, remove all of our resources. So part of what we're doing here with the Indigenous People Day Rocks is that we have harvest festivals. At the end of the year, we would gather up our crops that we grew along the riverbanks, the corns, the beans, the squash, those kind of things. And we would come together in a big feast, the harvest festival, and or a harvest. And we would trade, you know, crops amongst each other, put things up for the winter, process food, and just generally celebrate the bounty of the harvest and prepare for winter. So those are cycles that we still practice today. And we're having another event on the 25th of September at the BYCC, which is a harvest festival celebration, and also the October 9th, as me and Peter will talk about as well, to celebrate just the harvest.
Well, let me ask MA about that. October 9th, the second annual Indigenous Peoples Day Rocks, which is being put on with Stowe Vibrancy. So what are some of the events that will be held that day in Stowe?
Sure. Well, the event starts at 10:30, and from about 10:30 to 2:30, we'll have Indigenous drumming. Chief is coming with his Nalhegan drummers, and we'll also have exhibitors, Native demonstrations, food vendors happening during that time frame. The event's free and open to the public for that period. And then starting at 3 o'clock, from 3 till about 6:30 or 7, is the rock and roll component of the event. And we're bringing in Blues Award-winning recording artist Jill Lewis Walker.
Well, let's let Peter Schmeichel tell us about what he's got lined up for that rock and roll part of the event on October 9th.
Yeah, well, like you said, Jill Lewis Walker is headlining, and amazing, you know, blues legend. He's played with everybody, and we're really excited to have him here. Opening up for him is a local young singer named Bella Sanchez, Isabella Sanchez from Montpelier, and also Dave Keller, local Vermont.
We know Dave well here at WDEV. Dave.
And they're all backed up by our very own Vermont Jazz Trio. So it's a lineup of a little bit of kind of jazz with Bella. Dave brings kind of the soul blues, and then we've got the blues rock headlining the event.
And Chief, why is this type of event how you want to celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day?
Yeah, well, I mean, we celebrate Indigenous Peoples Day every day because that's who we are. I mean, we don't need a special day to celebrate who we are. We kind of, it's a day set aside to help educate others to be, so they get to see some of our culture, and, you know, we can kind of get together as a people and share our culture along with the public. But this also has another meaning to it as well. This partnership that we have developed, also helps with our food security programs. As you know, we're one of the highest we have one of the highest health disparity rates. You know, we're susceptible to COVID. We have vaccine. We're going to have a vaccine clinic there so people can get vaccinated because we had one of the lowest rates of vaccinations in the state. So it's an opportunity for other people, not just Native people, to get vaccinated if they're still hesitant. But we have a food security program. A lot of people stand in food lines. We know of the food security issues in Vermont. So we have actually a 24 herd or head bison herd that helps provide meat to our citizens. We have the garden crops, and we also have land access to gather natural foods and nuts and berries. And as you know, we just got our hunting and fishing rights. So all of this together helps feed our people. And we have three food distribution sites, one in Holland, one here at my house in Shelburne, and one in Conococ, New Hampshire, to try to provide nutritious food. So these types of programs not only educate the public about who we are, but it also helps support from the ticket sales and other donations our food programs. So there's a lot of benefit for these sort of programs, and we really value the partnerships that we have.
M.A., you're the executive director of Stowe Vibrancy. What is Stowe Vibrancy, and why are you partnering with the Abenaki for this special occasion?
Sure. Stowe Vibrancy is what we call a downtown designation organization. So we're one of a 52-member organization in the state of Vermont. We represent the town of Stowe and the community of Stowe. Our job is to help support businesses, our economics, produce events. Every town's a little bit different. We got involved with Indigenous Peoples Day. It was kind of a brainchild that we had last year after knowing that the state of Vermont had formally changed the holiday from what we used to call Columbus Day to Indigenous Peoples Day. With the chief, we started partnering him with him last year and just decided this was a great event to start putting on. And as the chief mentioned, all the money that we raise from this actually goes back to Abenaki Helping Abenaki. So it's a fundraiser for the tribe. Last year was a huge success, and we expect this year to be even bigger. We did it during a pandemic last year.
Yes, we did.
So we could only have 150 people. We're expecting over 500 this year.
M.A., let's make sure that we've got all the details for the event, where, when, how people get tickets, things like that.
Certainly, yeah. So Saturday, October 9th at the Mayo Fields in Stowe. It starts at 10:30 and runs until 6:30 or 7 o'clock. Tickets are available for the rock and roll component of the show at www.stowevibrancy.com. So that's Stowe Vibrancy. You can Google that and find the tickets.
Perfect.
The day component from 10:30 to 2:30 is free and open to the public. So come out, enjoy it. If you want to come and stay for the rock and roll component, you can get tickets the day of. Tickets are $25 pre-show, $30 day of.
All right. Let's take a call from Stephen, who's joining us from Montpelier. Stephen, go right ahead.
Yeah. I was wondering if the chief could comment on the meaning of some of the names of our rivers, such as the Connecticut, the Nalhegan, the Lamoille, the Missisquoi, the Winooski, maybe the Hoosick. I'm not sure if those are Abenaki names or not, but I was wondering if the chief could might know some of the meanings of those rivers.
Chief, go right ahead.
Yeah, like I'd mentioned, Nalhegan means place of the wooden traps or the wooden deadfall traps. And sorry, my phone's ringing here.
That's all right.
Winooski means onion river, place where the wild onions grow.
Mm-hmm.
And Missisquoi means place of the flint. So, like I said, they're all based on where things are and where things are located. So this is why we are the people that are place-based people, and that's why the places are named for what they offered when it came to resources, not just after people, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
So some of those names are still held today. Europeans just continue to use the name. So we know them as one place. Europeans may know other places that are the same under their naming convention. So it's still the same place, no matter what type of people, I don't want to say type of people, whether you're European or native or something, has a name for that place.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yep, it sure does. Stephen, thanks for that call. And Chief, while we're talking about the language, most of us say Abenaki. M.A., you mentioned you used the pronunciation of Abenaki. Is there a right or wrong way when we refer to the Abenaki people?
Well, it's like a potato or potato. It's
okay.
Like, well, basically what it is Abenaki has always been known as the U.S. translation for us. You know, like we are people of the first light or Dawnland people, which that's what Abenaki means, right? Place of the dawn, or again, it's place-based, or, you know, people who see the first light of day. So Abenaki is an English version of that. If you are in Canada and the French, we were allied with the French, they say Abenaki or Abenaki, which is kind of the English pseudo-French version of Abenaki. So both are technically correct. They're just pronounced differently. But it's like I said, it's potato, potato. It's all the same.
What a beautiful word.
Right or wrong.
Absolutely beautiful word, beautiful meaning. Peter, I want to talk more about the music, the rock and roll component of October 9th. And tell us how you put together the lineup, why you chose the groups that are going to be playing that day.
Sure. Well, Vermont Jazz Trio is kind of the house band, if you will. And we got Waterbury native Jeremy Hill on double bass. I shouldn't say native. I think he's from New Hampshire, but he lives here and teaches in Waterbury, Jeremy Hill. Local pianist phenom Remy Savard from Montpelier is our pianist. So it's kind of a local band of ringers. and that's the house band. And we've been together, I guess, through the pandemic. We started with a jazz brunch series, and we've done a Main Street Live series in Stowe. The groups or the headliners that we're backing up, we've got Bella Sanchez, and she's a young singer, just kind of on the scene. I think I first became aware of her at a Jennifer Hartswick concert at Zen Burn. She was being featured with the Vermont Jazz Ensemble, the big band. And Bella was just there checking it out, so I kind of noticed her, and then other friends were talking about her. Hey, you know, Bella and the Notables, have you been, you know, are you hip to that? And so just kind of became more and more aware of what she's up to. She's a young singer. She's a hustler. She's out there. She's going after it. So we wanted that energy, especially in the pandemic where people weren't doing much. You know, who was trying and who was hungry and who was, you know, trying to find work and just go after it. So she's an up-and-coming star and wanted to feature her. She's opening the show. Dave Keller, he was with us last year, and I was aware of Dave just – kind of being back in Vermont. I moved back in to Vermont in 2014, grew up in Barrie, but moved when I was 11. And coming back, you know, as a musician, you're wondering who's out there and who's playing. And, you know, it doesn't take long. You're aware Paul Asbell's got something going on, and Dave Keller, and these different things are happening. So Dave was definitely on my radar as somebody who's kind of a big name in Vermont. And we called him up last year. He was more than happy to join us. And last year he was the opener for Joanne Shenandoah. This year we're bringing him back to open for a friend of his, Joe Lewis Walker.
Wow.
And we got to thank Laura Carbone, who helped us kind of get in touch with Joe. She does some blues events up in Plattsburgh, I believe. And she kind of put us in touch with Joe Lewis Walker and his team. And we got a lineup for Indigenous People Say Rocks.
That's fantastic. Now, one other bit of music. Chief, I think you're part of the drum group that will be performing as well. Am I right?
Oh, that is correct. Last year we had four. Milhegan's known for our drums. So we had four big drums. I think we had somewhere close to 15 people or 20 people playing our songs in front of the stage last year. I think we'll have the same number of drums, if not people. So it's kind of, I don't like using the word powwow. It's more of a rendezvous where we drum and people can dance and or just listen to the music, do what their heart feels like. But we'll have a drum circle, which is kind of a dance area where people can, dance to our drums and our songs like you would at a powwow. We also have a native person doing some music during the day on one of our workshops. We'll also have some history. We might have some of our language. So you know, we'll have a few things that are going on. And like I said, we will have a vaccine clinic. I worked with the Department of Health to bring in a vaccine clinic so that way people who need a vaccine shot can get one. So I think it's going to be a good time. I also would like to shout out, make a shout out to some of the other partners. Like, you know, out of this whole process, you know, we've gotten great partners to help donate hay to our herd, you know, to help feed our bison, because we don't have a revenue source, a consistent revenue source. We live on kind of grants and donations and other things. So, you know, John Fusco was very heavily involved in the beginning last year, and Tony and the Bar Law Group and other partners like that who help also beyond just the Indigenous Peoples Day event, that other people and other partners, because it's all about partnerships, help provide stuff for our people to make it easier for us to uplift our people. So I just want to say there's many people behind the scenes. I really appreciate Ami, really appreciate Peter. They're kind of the face of this event from the Still Vibrancy side and the music. So they're kind of spearheading this. But also there's a lot of people behind the scenes that in order to make this possible. I just wanted to at least give everybody a shout out.
Absolutely. Don Stevens is chief of the Mohegan Band of the Cusick Abenaki Nation. Peter Schmickley is the music director of Indigenous Peoples Day Rocks. And Ami Green is the executive director of Stowe Vibrancy. The event, again, Saturday, October 9th at the Mayo Farm Fields. And to learn more about the event, you can go to stowevibrancy.com. I want to thank all three of you for being with me this morning. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Rick.
Thank you.
All right, Rick.
Can you at least if people want to know about more about our people and our culture, could they can go to www.abenakitribe.org, and they can kind of see us from a year-round perspective if they would like. I just wanted to at least put our website there in case other people want to learn more.
You got it, abenakitribe.org. All right, we're going to take a break for CBS News, get an update, and then when we come back, more music to hear about the Tiny Museum of Vermont Music History. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Vermont is a way of packing a lot of interesting stuff into a small area. Well, look at the state overall. But we've also got the Museum of Everyday Life in Glover. We've got Matt Necker's Vermont International Museum of Contemporary Art and Design that is in a trailer up in northern Vermont. And now we can add the Tiny Museum of Vermont Music History, created by Big Heavy World. Here to introduce us to the museum, some Vermont music history, and other projects that they're working on is Big Heavy World's Executive Director, James Lockridge. James, welcome to Vermont Viewpoint.
Oh, thank you so much, Rick. I'm glad to be here.
Oh, we're happy to have you. Listeners, if you'd like to ask James about Vermont music, you can call 244-1777 or 877-291-8255. James, first of all, what is Big Heavy World?
Oh, my gosh. Well, for about 25 years, we've been a nonprofit organization run by volunteers dedicated to archiving and promoting original music from Vermont. And over that time, our work has expanded into a number of projects, including a tiny radio station in downtown Burlington, an archive of music, a website about the music sector in the state, and sort of an ongoing list of special projects like documentary film and surveys of the economic sector It kind of goes on and on, but it's people with a love for local music participating in making that community stronger and making sure there's evidence of today's music in the future.
You have been involved since the beginning. How did the whole thing get started?
Well, a long time ago in the 90s, I was a graphic designer, and that was when the Internet was brand new, so it was just the most exciting thing as could be to have a new medium to play with as, you know, in that trade. So we built a website. I did this with my engineer housemate, George Webb, and Big Heavy World was born as a website that was an encyclopedia of local music. And artists brought us their press kits, which included their CDs. And after a period of time, we had hundreds of CDs, which became the nucleus of our archive. And we realized we had a responsibility to this cultural legacy. And that's when things got a little more purposeful.
Well, what are initiatives that you undertake to help local musicians?
Well, I think at the top of that list, we pursued a license for a radio station that we now use to host musicians on weekly for performances and interviews on Wednesday nights. And those become podcasts that you can find at bigheavyworld.com. And so we've had about 700 artists come through so far.
Wow.
And that's just, you know, a joy for us and our volunteers, who are mostly young, to have such a close-up experience with live vocal music. In our past, we've always had a very close relationship with emerging technology. So back in the 90s, we were streaming concerts from Club Toast, for instance, and we were getting Vermonters into digital distribution when that was a brand new technology. And in our museum, you'll find some of the very first MP3 players, like before there were iPods, where we were working with those companies to pre-install Vermont-made music in them, and as they were shipped out of the factory. So, you know, we try to have fun grabbing on to new tools for promoting local music.
Well, you mentioned 700 bands who have come to the radio station there. So this next question might be a little difficult, but can you point to any bands that needed some support, encouragement, love from Big Heavy World, and that really set them on their way?
Wow. You know, I prefer not – it's like that question I process as though, were there any Vermont bands in need of our – patronage. And we operate with the intent to empower people, mm-hmm. to maybe give them resources that they can work with on their own to advance themselves. Like, we take photo portraits, we provide the recordings of shows, we celebrate all original music in this state, regardless of its experience. So I don't think we have a gauge in our possession for deciding who's needy or not, or more needy, of this kind of support. It's accessible to everybody. It's intended to be inclusive and equitable.
Yeah, fair point. Is the Vermont music scene, the local music scene, still going strong, still robust?
You know, it's if you were to take the time to just sort of graze the performances and the podcasts, you would be stupefied by the breadth of style and originality and talent. So, you know, Vermont has been offering up a very, very deep and wide community of music in an ongoing way for as long as we've been around, which is 25 years this year.
What effect have you seen that the pandemic has had on the artists and venues here in Vermont?
Well, the venues, the pandemic was crushing to the performing arts industry, crushing. Just absolutely, you know, just pounded it down to nothing when the venues were closed. And an outcome of that was, I believe, an increase in the technical proficiency with the streaming technologies that continue to bring us together, and I'm sure will be a tool for community building in the future. And it also gave people in policymaking positions exposure to the precarious economic situation that Vermont's artists are in, because they aren't formalized businesses necessarily. So when recovery supports came through the state, adjustments had to be made to be sure that recovery supports traveled to our artists, who would have been left out if that very thoughtful, you know, focus wasn't brought by, you know, people like the leadership of our Arts Council and Humanities Council.
Now, you have been so tied to the local music scene for, you know, this quarter century. I'm not sure. Have you ever been in any local bands yourself? Do you play an instrument, James?
No, I picked up an electric bass back in the mid-90s when I started Big Heavy World. And you know, at that time in my life, I spent every night at live music, and I'd come home at 2 in the morning, and I worked on Big Heavy World until I fell asleep. And you know, that was my lifestyle way back then. And at the time, I had just picked up this instrument and was learning to play, but didn't have time to follow through with it. So these days, I daydream of learning harmonica, but I've never been
a frustrated musician, but who's helped so many other bands get them exposure and kind of support them here in Vermont. So what is the Tiny Museum of Vermont Music History?
Well, in 2019, our organization had the opportunity to curate the local history gallery, which is a big room inside the state's historical society museum right in the middle of Montpelier. Mm-hmm. And from the artifacts that we had sort of organically accumulated over the years, combined with artifacts that were loaned to us, we filled the room with a combination of things to look at and interactive stuff. And it was really a pleasure to do. And it was in the museum for about 6 months. And during that time, we prepared the back half of our space in Burlington to become a tiny museum. We painted, we sought and received donation of museum stands. We thought through where things would end up. And when the exhibit in Montpelier concluded, we brought everything back here. Spent a couple years adding to the collection, seeking donations or loans of additional artifacts. And now we filled the space, and our job is to fill it some more with a filter towards including everybody, which means, you know, ultimately we're going to have to occupy a multi-story building. At present, it's about 20 feet by 30 feet, a very densely packed history from Vermont's music.
Where is it, and when can people tour the Tiny Museum of Vermont Music History?
It's located in a big red industrial building called the Howard Space, which is on Pine Street in Burlington. And if you're local or you're familiar with arts in Chittenden County, you know it as sort of the center of the South End Art Hop. It's right next door to Speeder and Earl's, the coffee shop. Mm-hmm. It's behind the very cool lamp shop. It's across the street from dealer.com, right on the corner of Howard and Pine. And our door is on the Howard Street side. And when you come in the door, we're right there. And we're open from 6 to 8 p.m. on Wednesdays every week. And we're open then because that's when our volunteer crew comes in and gets things done and then hosts our radio show at 8 o'clock.
Oh, fantastic. All right. James, what are some of the items that people will find at the Tiny Museum?
Oh, gosh. Well, I suppose I could start anywhere. And Big Heavy World started in the 90s, so I'm walking up to our exhibit.
Oh, and we lost James. All right, we'll try to get him back as he's walking upstairs to the Tiny Museum of Vermont Music History. It's put on by Big Heavy World, and it is open on Wednesday nights from 6 to 8 p.m., and that is, I think he said, the Howard Building, which is on just off Pine Street and next to, across from the dealer.com building. It looks like we've got James back, and we'll find out what some of those special items are that he's now amongst. Go ahead, James.
I'm going to do less wandering around here and hope okay. that our connection stays. I'm standing at a table when Club Toast opened in Burlington, Vermont in the mid-90s. The tables were handmade, and they included lots of metal bits of all kinds under a resin. Mm-hmm. And they were super cool and unique. And Justin Wickens, a co-owner of Toast, donated a table to us and a crew coat that's embroidered with a T-shirt from the last night of Toast in 98. And
We have a postcard of the calendar from way back then, so you can relive a little of, you know, a very active time in Burlington's downtown music scene with, you know, with being reminded of it with this stuff. We also have a set of musical instruments that were handmade and donated to us by Brian Blanchett. And it was so nice to hear the segment prior to this one about the October event with the Abenaki cultural experience. And, you know, we have a video and instruments and descriptions and of some of the traditional Abenaki musical instruments. And, you know, being exposed to this and learning more about it as we prepared labels is, it just makes the world bigger to, you know, to come to understand the context of some of these things.
Yeah. Was there something you learned or were reminded of as you were putting together the museum?
Yes. I think I learned a little more about a tiny bit more about how Nectar Roris and his outlook towards nectars as a business, which was just a delight. I learned a lot more about the musical background of Big Joe Burrell. A centerpiece of the museum is Big Joe's tenor saxophone. It's in a large case and has his name engraved in the bell of the instrument. And that was made possible for us by a gift from Todd R. Lockwood and Burlington's City Office for Racial Equity, Inclusion, and Belonging, who pitched in to help us purchase this from Big Joe's relatives. Mm. And reading his biography, you know, even in an abbreviated form, was really, really enlightening. He had a long, deep musical history across the country in Canada. And, you know, we know him in Burlington as, you know, a beloved legend, but the Big Joe experience extended across the continent, which was, you know, fun to learn.
Yeah, and it is great to hear the different genres of music that are represented there at the Tiny Museum of Vermont Music History. James, what are some seminal moments in Vermont music history that people will learn about at the museum?
Oh, that's tough because we haven't timelined anything.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a tiny museum run by volunteers who understand how completely unfinished this is. You know, we are aggressively strategizing how to represent women and our LGBTQ music community, the Latin community in Vermont, music community. There's just an unending list of yet to do's, and so, you know, if you look around our museum as it stands now, I think probably the most prominent historical call it a spread, you know, over decades that's represented is our interactive display and the office door from 242 Main, the teen center in Burlington that was established under Bernie Sanders when he was mayor. That was a teen program run by the city that was programmed by the teens themselves. And for 30 years, kids' lives were changed by having that kind of resource where they could interact with their peers, be exposed to people their age making critical life decisions and singing about that kind of thing or talking about it from stage, being creative in front of them and setting an example. It was a very empowering and very socially safe space for young people, and it lasted for 30 years.
Mm-hmm.
And so we've captured a lot of that history.
Oh, that's a neat item to have. You opened up during the South End Art Hop. So what has been the reaction of people who have visited the Tiny Museum so far?
Well, the comments, you know, that have sort of buoyed my spirits are the ones where people come in and say, there's so much to look at. Because, you know, we've lived with this for several years as we put it together. So we're very familiar with what's in every corner. And for the impression of someone visiting to be that there's a lot here is really nice. You know, it's fulfilling. And it's a very, it's sort of set up like one of those old Wild West tourist trap museums where there's something on every corner of every wall, you know, of significance or of curiosities. So it can be engrossing if you're interested in the subject of music in Vermont. There's not a lot of negative space in here. There's none.
Hmm. And I'm sure you probably hear, you know, someone looking around and then all of a sudden spot something from, I don't know, Chin Ho, right? And they're like, oh, my God, Chin Ho. I forgot all about them. They were so cool. You know, it must be pretty wonderful to hear those reactions as people spot something that just takes them right back to a favorite venue or a favorite band from Vermont.
That has happened. One moment I can share is I looked over and there was a woman making a very dramatic repeated bows to the table from Toast in front of the table. Just, you know, there's parts of our history that are very special to people, you know, especially when it's at a time of your life where maybe things are formative for you. You know, I have fond memories of Nectars where I worked and saw music and Toast where Big Heavy World was young when Toast was active and 242, you know, for the values it stands for. I attended shows there, you know, all my time in Burlington. So, yeah. Other people have very similar experiences, I think.
The Tiny Museum of Vermont Music History is a big name for a small space highlighting a big subject. Does it have a shorter nickname yet?
No. You know, when I was jamming out a flyer for the wall so people would know what door to go through to find it, I said, Tiny Museum, Mighty History. So, you know, that was as short as it got. In any category. I'd never want our grassroots volunteer run nonprofit organization to step forward and say, you know, we're something like, I wouldn't want people to misinterpret what we are, what we have the capacity to offer, you know, we're not a big city museum and I wouldn't want somebody to be disappointed imagining we might be. So the tiny is an important part of the title these days. You know, and of course, there's no lid on it growing.
Yeah.
With community support, or you know, a more space to work with. This could grow meaningfully into something a little more.
James, we have about a minute and a half left. I do want to ask you what other projects or events that Big Heavy World is working on right now.
Well, in October, we're planning a Vermont music yearbook shoot in our hallway in celebration of the reveal of our very large photo mural of Vermont music. It's over 40 feet long, and we're going to have a little party welcoming that to the world in October. The date is tentatively October 22nd. November 13th, we're co-hosting a conference at Main Street Landing for artists who want to make social change, and give them some tools that give them, you know, skills that'll be helpful for that. And we are in the middle of editing a documentary about 242 Maine, where we've recorded close to 70 full-length interviews and compiled hundreds and hundreds of photos and poster art in the hands of our filmmaker now.
Wow. I arrived to Vermont too late. I was too old to enjoy 242 Maine, but it is great to hear from those who did in their youth go to 242 Maine and how they still reflect on what a special time in their life it was. So that'll be a really neat documentary. James Lockridge is the executive director of Big Heavy World. Listeners, to learn more about their work and about the Tiny Museum of Vermont Music History and the upcoming events, you can visit bigheavyworld.com. James, it was great having you on the show this morning. Thank you so much.
No, thank you, Rick. Lovely being here.
All right, take care. All right, we're going to take a break for CBS News. We'll get an update. Then we'll be back to hear how Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice's work has been supporting COVID response in the community. And coming up today at 11 o'clock, we've got Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre. This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV.
Let our staff at the Warren Store ease you back into a pre-pandemic lifestyle. We can cater your postponed events and even bake you a custom cake. We can dress you in comfortable casual clothing. Make it a day trip for the best one-stop shopping in Vermont. Have lunch on our deck, head upstairs for some much-needed retail therapy, then treat yourself to a specialty coffee from our new espresso machine. You can pick up a colorful Warren Store beach towel for a dip in the river, and how about a delicious house-made ice cream sandwich? Fun, funky, safe, and friendly. Warren Store, Main Street, Warren Village, and warrenstore.com.
This is Vermont Viewpoint on WDEV. Getting Vermont vaccinated at a rate of over 85% is outstanding. But it doesn't happen without the work of many individuals and organizations. And one of those organizations has been Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice. We're going to take the next half hour to learn about those efforts and what President Biden's Path Out of the Pandemic plan will mean for CVHHH. Here to discuss these issues and more is Sandy Roos, CVHHH's, Sandy Roos is CVHH's president and CEO. Sandy, welcome back to Vermont Viewpoint.
Thanks, Rick, for having me again. We love WDEV. They're great supporters of ours and certainly for our Central Vermont community.
And listeners, if you want to ask Sandy about CVHHH, you can call us 244-1777, 877-291-8255, vtviewpoint@radiovermont.com. Sandy, I hope you don't mind if I turn the clock back a little and ask you to go over the past year and a half at CVHHH. Through the pandemic, did you close at all or discontinue services?
No, we didn't actually. We were open for business for the duration of the pandemic. So ultimately, we were able to continue to provide care at home. Certainly, we quickly had to shift to mitigate risk of exposure for our staff as well as our patients and families. We were able to really, we had a telehealth program already in place. We were able to shift to that. In addition to that, phone calls as well. So we really had a whole consortium of staff just really coming together, learning what they needed to do and how they needed to do it. And certainly we had great IT support as well, because a good share of our staff are remote on a regular basis, those individuals that take care of our clients out in the field. And so they could really plug in and just work from home and start their day there and end their day there without really many hiccups at all. So we were really fortunate. I know there was some guidance from the state of Vermont, from the Department of Disabilities, Aging, and Independent Living, related to some of our long-term care services, some of those services that are non-medically necessary but are really critical in keeping individuals at home and out of facilities, such as a skilled nursing facility. And they said some of those services were non-essential, but we really took it upon us to really determine what services were non-essential by individual and really get them what they needed and when they needed, with phone call check-ins or video check-ins in between our visits.
It was a real challenge for any business to stay safe, but for CVHHH, which is providing care at home for people, working with patients, working with these clients, how were you able to do that and ensure the safety of both clients and staff?
Well, really, I think, like I said, Rick, with regards to telehealth, we had already had a telehealth program in place. So really, it was just a matter of making sure everyone was really well trained in that and working with our clients and families to ensure that they were able to have that connectivity as we needed it. And certainly those individuals that were at higher risk, we had to continue to see them in person. So we had our staff building face shields for us, because PPE was certainly a challenge in the very beginning. We also had to support some of our physician practices who didn't have cameras on their computers, so they couldn't automatically just go into the realm of video telehealth. They could certainly do phone calls. So we really had to be that organization that was really backing up our community for the first few weeks there. And our staff did it with courage, and our families and patients and community really supported us in many, many different ways. And our staff were really open to even redeploying their talents. So we were very fortunate to make that happen. And like I said, our IT support was tremendous.
with telehealth, how many of those visits, you know, did CVHHH make? What, you know, how much did you have to shift from in-person to these telehealth or telemedicine visits?
We actually did over 2,000 telemedicine visits.
Whoa.
So that was a significant increase for us. We probably were doing about 500 or less. Certainly, a lot of the goal of our service is to see individuals in person.
Mm-hmm.
But what we had shifted a bit in doing right before the coronavirus hit is really putting eyes on individuals. So being able to look at someone and have them speak to a nurse on the other end sometimes really just provides them with that extra support to really keep them out of the hospital. Also to identify changes that may happen. You know, when you talk to somebody and you see them, lots of times it's very different than if you just talk to them on the phone. So we had already started to make some of those shifts. So actually it played really well into where we wanted to go in the long run. So.
Yeah, so as you mentioned, you had already been shifting that way, but how do you make someone feel comfortable? I think we all, when we're talking about our health, feel most comfortable being in the presence of a healthcare provider. So how do you make someone, one of your clients, feel really comfortable using the telemedicine rather than the in-person visit?
Right. So I really think a lot of it has to do with relationships, and because we work in the home on a regular basis, we actually have more of an opportunity, I think, to create those relationships, and we're part of that environment. So we really work with the individual. We had iPads that we could certainly give out if those individuals didn't have they weren't part of our telehealth program originally. And we look to whether it's a family member or a caregiver or a neighbor that could come over and walk them through it. We had staff on the other end. Things are made really easy, actually, to do video visits for really any age individual. And I think the goal was really we're really trying to mitigate the exposure of the risk of exposure. And ultimately, you're going to see a nurse on the other end. You're going to get to know that person. And they're going to be that person you can call if you're not getting an in-person visit.
Mm-hmm.
So that's, you know, really everyone was deployed doing that. And I think just the overall, you know, wanting to stay safe and wanting to be in their home and not go to the hospital was really a motivator for everybody to kind of say, we have to adopt this somehow, some way, and we're going to do that. And for those that couldn't, we went in person and we put on our equipment, and that's what we did.
Yeah, let's talk about those in-person visits, because especially early on, we were very nervous, very concerned. I think we're a little bit more lax now, but you can't be. So what infection controls and screening protocols have you adopted for your staff and clients?
Right. So actually, our staff are required to self-monitor. We have a really strict policy that if you're sick, you are not to come to work. And certainly you are not to visit patients. We have a COVID hotline internally that those individuals call into, and we go through a screening with them, and then we refer them to their primary care physician, and we wait for correspondence with regards to next steps as to their return to work, whether they need COVID testing or whatnot. We were really fortunate that we had a handful or less of COVID-positive employees that actually were acquired through the community, not from patients, and certainly not given to patients. So knock on wood, we've really been in a good position, and we feel that a lot of those protocols have helped. When it comes to working with our patients and families, we certainly asked our patients and families, anybody that was present, to wear masks. We brought them masks. We even brought them paper bags to keep their mask in, to have for the next visit in case it would get misplaced over time. We screen those individuals before we go for every visit, and we certainly were screening at the door as well and asking if there was anyone else in the home. And then once we got in the home, the goal was really if we had procedures we needed to do that were where we had to be close and within 6 feet, we were doing those and then stepping back, but explaining the whole time through our visits what we were doing and how we were doing it. And our staff were wearing surgical masks with face shields the whole time for any client. And then certainly if anyone was considered potentially positive or positive, then they had the full gear on, the N95s, the face shields, the gloves, the gowns, you name it. So,
wow.
So, yeah, I think, you know, and now through this, all of this, our staff continue to wear goggles and surgical masks, and more than likely we'll probably look at going back to face shields in the very near future now that the real heat has subsided. Mm-hmm. So that really gives us the really best protection we can to really protect everybody.
Sandy, I know you were involved in the administration of COVID-19 vaccinations. So to whom and how many did CVHHH give?
Right. So we certainly were involved in the vaccination rollout, and we had tremendous partners with our local EMS units, especially in Waterbury, Barrie, and Barrie City, as well as East Montpelier. So we gave over 1,000 COVID-19 vaccines in the home, and certainly we served not only individuals that were currently active on our census, but others as well in the community, and we coordinated that work through Waterbury EMS, with them. So we were able to really reach as many individuals as possible and get them what they needed at the, you know, at the right place in their home.
And what about COVID-19 testing for patients and community members?
Right. So we were really fortunate to start really early when the COVID pandemic hit, and in concert with Central Vermont Medical Center, and really being able to get the test kits and send those tests to their lab and all that. So it, we were very fortunate. We gave probably over 150 to 200 tests. We continue to do testing. We continue to do vaccines. We are doing boosters for those that qualify at this time. We will be doing them as we learn more about boosters coming up. And we'll be working once again with our EMS partners and other healthcare partners in the community to get those boosters out to those individuals.
There have been a lot of neat programs that have come about because of the pandemic. One that I'm really happy about is called Vermont Everyone Eats. Uh-huh. So what was your involvement there? And tell people, again, a little bit more about what that is, Vermont Everyone Eats.
Right. So the Vermont Everyone Eats program was a pretty amazing program, and it partnered with our local restaurants to really help them be able to manage their business during such a time where most restaurants were closed, if not all of them. And they were preparing food with funding from the state, which allowed, then they were working with not-for-profit organizations in the community in our area. Capstone, formerly Central Vermont Community Action, was the hub, and many not-for-profit organizations were able to participate in that. We had a huge fridge downstairs, and we delivered ourselves over 10,000 meals to Central Vermonters. They were all also able to be accessed by any employees and family members or neighbors that they were aware of that needed meals. So they weren't just individuals on our current active census. So that was an amazing program. We're still doing some of that work, and we're really happy that we can be a part of that.
Looking ahead, how will President Biden's October 1st mandate affect CVHHH and its staff?
Right. So President Biden's mandate currently, as of October 1st, we've already put a note out to all of Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice employees, clinicians, direct field staff, administrative staff, per diem staff, part-time staff, that they will have to be fully vaccinated against COVID-19, which means from a Moderna and Pfizer perspective, they will have to be 2 weeks out after their second dose of either one of those. And for Johnson & Johnson, after that first dose, 14 days out from that as well. And if they aren't fully vaccinated, they will be subject to a weekly testing that we will do here on site at the organization. And there will be very few abilities to opt out of that or miss those testing appointments with us.
For those who haven't been vaccinated so far on your staff, how have you been ensuring the safety of your clients and other staff members?
Right. So really, Rick, we kind of go back to when this all started, right, and there
yeah.
wasn't a vaccine that existed. And personal protective equipment truly has held what it is supposed to be doing in the sense of why we use it and what it does for us from an infection control perspective. So we ensure that all our individuals are wearing goggles and surgical masks. They're cleaning those goggles in between visits. They're changing their surgical mask in between visits. Before all of that, before they even go into a client's home, certainly they're screening those individuals. And if there's any question of potential positivity, they are doing the full garb with the N95 and the face shield and all that before they even go in and speaking to their manager. And then certainly kind of even backing it up further, just monitoring our staff for illness, et cetera. Granted, they're self-monitoring, but I feel really good that based on the amount of calls that we've had and the call-outs we've had, I believe staff are doing the right thing and the ability for us to actually mitigate risk of exposure through all that. So PPE is really our savior in all of this, and I really do believe that the staff have done a tremendous job in that based on the number of positive employees that ultimately we've had over the 19 months.
Speaking of staff, Sandy, looking at your website, there are some jobs advertised there. So what type of individual would be a good fit for CVHHH?
Well, certainly an individual that really wants to use their skills. So when you go into the home, I think, you know, in the past when I first started in this profession, and it was over 20 years ago, and I was on the board and then came on in a different role into the organization, a lot of the work we did was skilled care and high-tech care and all that, but a lot of it was also having the ability to monitor individuals to make sure, monitor them to make sure they're not going back to the hospital. Because lots of times people get better and they kind of slip down again. So certainly right now, how it is these individuals and patients that we see, they're sick, they need care, and they need high-level skilled care. And certainly we do all sorts of skilled care in the field. It is definitely not like it used to be. You know, we do wound care, we do wound vacs, we do PICC lines, you know, and administering medications through PICC lines. Certainly we're taking care of individuals that have, you know, CHF and COPD, that's chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, congestive heart failure, you know, those all sorts of diagnoses. And really, somebody's stay in a hospital is a lot shorter nowadays, right? So many years ago, you go in for a pneumonia and you could stay maybe 5 to 10 days easy.
Right.
Nowadays, you don't necessarily stay that long. So you're coming home and you really need somebody that has strong skills to take care of you in that home. And then there are certainly other unskilled positions which are just as critical, such as our personal care attendants. And they're really working with individuals on all sorts of stuff. They're in the home the longest, and they're helping them prep meals. They're providing companionship. They're doing laundry. They're helping them clean. They're helping them manage their checkbooks, et cetera, all the things that they need to be able to stay at home and not have to go to a facility. So there's just an array of services and that we offer, and we offer services from, you know, pre-birth to end of life. So we have maternal and child health programs to do pediatric nursing. Certainly we have end of life care nursing. We have high tech nursing, which, you know, takes care of individuals on vents and needs a high level of care. And then certainly everything in between. So if you want to really use your nursing skills, this is the place to use them.
Sandy, we have about 30 seconds left. As a healthcare professional, why do you think it is important for people to get the COVID vaccine?
I really think it is important. Ultimately, we want to provide, you know, the patient experience of care that is a good experience. So especially when you're going into individuals' homes or you're out in the community next to them, whether you're in a restaurant or a grocery store or whatever, it's really, you need to think beyond yourself, and you really need to think about other people that could really have a really negative, you know, reaction to getting the coronavirus. And certainly this is a pandemic. This is like the polio. The only way we're going to eradicate this is to be vaccinated. And the more people that are vaccinated, we know that it's been proven in the past that it can eradicate some of these diseases. And that's really because inevitably it's going to impact the community. It's going to impact how we deliver care. It's just going to fragment everything if we really can't get over the hump and get to the other side of this.
Sandy Roos is President and CEO of Central Vermont Home Health and Hospice. To learn more, you can visit cvhhh.org. Sandy, thank you so much for being on the program again this morning.
Thank you for having me, Rick, and I hope this helped, and I look forward to anyone reaching out to me directly.
All right. That is our show for today. Vermont Viewpoint is directed by Danny McGivergan, and you can listen to past episodes of Vermont Viewpoint by downloading the podcast at WDEV Radio. Common Sense Radio with Bill Sayre is up next. I'm Rick Zingari. I'll meet you back here tomorrow.